welcome all of you to Westgate on this garden party. And the most important thing is that we pray that the rain holds off. It's been threatening, as you are aware, all day. Am I coming through?
Yes.
Threatening all day. So we just hope that it will hold off for the rest of this afternoon. Welcome to you. A number of you are here as old members of the House. A number of you here because you're associated either with the current work of the House or also through colleges, director of studies, pastoral supervisors and so forth. So I welcome all of you on this occasion. Just a couple of words about, just a sort of update about how we are. The ordinaries will tell you how we really are. From my point of view, we seem to be in good heart. We have just said farewell to 29 leavers who went to parishes or are in the process of going to parishes from Cornwall to Northumberland. And so we're spread as usual right across the country. And we had a wonderful farewell to them on Friday afternoon. And then the returners, those who are coming back next year, leave this Thursday. So the end of term is on Thursday this week. And we're looking forward, or with some trepidation, to a community that will be larger by at least 10 next year. We've got a huge intake, and which is very encouraging. It's probably the largest intake we've ever had. I was talking to Stephen Ferns at Ministry Division this morning, who was reassuring me that this was not just our problem. There is seems to be a national surge at the moment in numbers, which is very good to hear. Although I did get out of it that we didn't seem to be doing particularly well for that. We've had, in terms of staffing, it's always good to sort of update people, particularly old members, on who's here. And unlike last year, where we said farewell to various people, I'm not saying anything else this year, but we have welcomed in the course of the year Leslie, who's assistant bursar, who is not here, I think she's doing working up in the office at the moment. Alex, who's the admissions and tutorial secretary, and Tracy Walton, who was on housekeeping, has moved into office administration. It is a great gift for us because, of course, she knows the place and has known it for so long and knows people associated with the community when the rest of us are relatively new. We welcome Helen Arnold, who's joined the House as a tutor. And we also welcome a new neighbour around the corner, whose picture will appear in a moment when John starts his talk. It's been lovely to have Rowan here. He pops in from time to time. We've got an understanding that he'll do about one thing a term for us, besides just informally coming in and having various associations with staff and students. And it's refreshing to see a man who's relieved not to be doing the job he wasn't doing, and is quite outspoken about that fact too. Each year I say something about we're on the verge of major fundraising. Well, I'm going to say it again, we're on the verge of major fundraising. We've spent the last couple of years planning for, as any of these ventures require, planning for fundraising for capital funds, pretty cheaply. Because of the growth of the community, but even without the growth, simply in order to provide the accommodation facilities for the size of community that we have been for the last 10 or 15 years, we need to expand both accommodation and teaching and office space. So we've got plans for that, and I'm hoping that we will be formally launching the appeal sometime in the course of the next year. That's well in place, and we're just putting together some final details for it. Without without any further ado, then, I want to hand over to our speaker. First of all, to introduce him. John Hughes is the Dean of Jesus. He was previously the chaplain of Jesus across the road, so he's had almost the shortest trip today. He was here at Westcote between 2001 and 2005, and was here for 4 years because he was doing his PhD while he was here. And he teaches philosophy, ethics, and social thought in various contexts in the University and the Faculty of Divinity. His dissertation was published under the title The End of Work, Theological Critiques of Marxism, of Capitalism, sorry. Has a book which has just been published in the States and will be published in this country in November, called The Unknown God, Sermons Responding to the New Atheists, a collection of sermons preached in Jesus Chapel, and will be published, in the US, will be published in this country by SCN. But if you want to buy it, you can get it on Amazon.com. John is a member and has been since its inception of a project which we're calling the Westcote Urban Resource Group, which is a grouping of clergy and academics who meet together two or three times a year to talk about particular challenges and issues in urban ministry and to begin to try and tease out both the practical issues in ministry that clergy are facing, but also to see what the shape of a theology of urban ministry is now in a very changing context. He's also involved in an important project on Anglican social thought, which has been organised by Malcolm Brown at the Department for Mission and Public Affairs in Church House. This is very much John's field of engagement. And he's going to talk to us now about Bishop Westcote and his legacy to the title of Westcote to Williams and the renewal of Anglican social thought. So we will now, it's actually Westcote to Williams, the renewal of facial hair.
Thank you, Martin, and it's very nice to be back in the Westcote Chapel. Apologies to those of you, for having to be here to listen to a lecture at the garden party. I was slightly mystified when Martin originally mentioned this, because I don't even remember having been to the lectures before, so maybe I just turned up afterwards rather than regular. But because of that, I'll keep it short and rather more chatty than a formal lecture. So this is coming out of the work that I've been involved with Malcolm Brown. Apologies also to those ordinands here who may have seen some versions of bits of this before in an earlier stage, and apologies to any clergy from Emmanuel College who may see a later version of it later in the summer. So what does the church have to say about society? That's the sort of opening question, as it were, for Anglican social thought. But if you've not heard this phrase before, what do we mean by Anglican social thought? I think this phrase that has become used a bit more in the last few years is really a phrase that's been borrowed by analogy from the Roman Catholic Church, where CST, as it's called, Catholic Social Teaching, is a well-known phenomenon that you get collections of the papal documents, lectures, that form this body of teaching opinion. So this perhaps leads into a sort of opening question for us, this contrast between the Roman Catholic social teaching, which is clearly defined and is written in certain documents, has a clearly authoritative force, and then the Church of England. What does it look like for us to have social teaching? So perhaps we might think of it as more of a dispersed magisterium. So sort of set up of teachings that are authoritative in a looser way, more like a living tradition. So you've got here some theologians, some bishops, some church reports, synod, a hymn book, social activists and reformers, just giving you a sense of how diverse the sources for Anglican social thought might be, although I'll be focusing mainly on recent theological works. If people think of Anglican social thought at all, they might well think of the temple tradition, as it's called. This was the post-war Anglican consensus, more or less, on social questions that you find reflected in most of the big synod reports through the 70s and 80s on social questions, and in the work of the William Temple Foundation. So they look back to William Temple, Archbishop of Canterbury, during the Second World War, as a figure representative of the church having the confidence to speak to wider society. And that sort of image, as it were, of the church having played a key part in the formation of the welfare state is very important for this tradition. And here we've got Temple at the bottom, then Ronald Preston, who was involved with the William Temple Foundation in Manchester, Hapgood there, Richard Harries, Peter Sidgwick as well, probably one of the most prominent current representatives of that tradition. And this temple tradition could be characterised by what Sidgwick calls a liberal conservatism. It's a rather confusing claim. I think he means liberal in the sense of a political philosophy, liberal with a capital L, but conservative in the sense that it's speaking from the position of establishment and presuming that society is going to listen. Then this rather technical phrase for those interested in political theory, it has a basically Weberian and Kantian approach to modernity. It sees modernity as the advance of reason and progress that certainly the church has to come to terms with. It developed this natural law tradition, a way of speaking to the wider society without necessarily using such explicitly Christian points of reference, by this theory of what was called middle axioms. So translating Christian values into supposedly more generic, middle axioms that could then form the basis for political policy in the wider society. It has a tendency, this tradition, to speak in what has sometimes been called a royal commission style. So they would produce reports, whether these were synodical reports or reports from the Board of Mission, or reports by groups of bishops or foundations, that would be based on empirical research and often addressed to the government. This is what we should do. So not so much necessarily addressed to the church or to individual Christians, but addressed to the British state. So if that was the dominant post-war British Anglican tradition of social thought, it would be fair to say that from the mid-80s onwards, this tradition began to wane and came under fire, to more or less of a degree, from a number of critics. So these critics claim that this tradition was often insufficiently theological, that it was too secular, that it was too statist, that it wasn't so concerned with international questions or local questions, but only with questions of national politics, and that it was too optimistic about the possibility of building a rational social consensus that everyone would agree upon. So here, two very prominent philosopher-theologian critics of that sort of liberal, Kantian, Weberian way of thinking. Alistair McIntyre, on the left, the Roman Catholic philosopher and ethicist, just put this typical McIntyrean question here that he might put to the Anglican, to the temple tradition. Whose justice are you talking about, and which rationality? So you can see that sort of more postmodern, if you like, way of thinking, which you can't just presume that everyone has the same understanding of justice or the same understanding of reason. And then on the right here, Stanley Hawass, the quotation from him was actually at a Westcott organised event in Wesley a couple of years ago, where he said in his inimitable Texan drawl, "I remember the first time I heard these people talking from the temple tradition, and I thought they sound like Reinhold Niebuhr in Ecclesiastical Drag." So Reinhold Niebuhr is an American theologian, post-war American theologian who Hawass doesn't like, for example. So that's what's going on there. But then moving beyond temple, So this is quite a whirlwind journey, as you can see. In the last few years, I think we have seen something like a recent renewal of the Anglican social tradition. Although many of these people don't think of themselves as being part of the Anglican social tradition, and indeed many of the temple people were initially suspicious of seeing these other people as their successors, as it were. And these writers were mainly philosophical, political, theologians, and ethicists, and they were Anglicans. And I've mentioned these ones here, John Milbank, Graham Ward, so two alumni of this house. John Milbank, professor in Nottingham, Graham Ward, now Regius Professor in Oxford, who in ways took on those sort of McIntyrean and Halvassian challenges to those critiques of liberalism and gave a more theological account of them. And then here's Sam Wells, who you can just make out famously there, now the vicar of St. Martin in the Fields, who spent many years in Duke and became, as it were, the sort of English Stanley Halvass. And Luke Bretherton, who was based at King's College London, involved in the programme working there with London citizens and a lot of the community organising programmes there, who's now just swapped places with Sam by going over to Duke. So this group of theologians, I think you can see the taking on board of some of these criticisms of the temple tradition and a new and different shape to Anglican social thought. Now, this recent renewal then, if I was to summarise what it looks like, I'd say it looks more theological and more ecclesial. There's no sense that one needs to translate doctrinal ideas into some sort of general middle axioms or universal categories of reason. And more ecclesial, more interested in the life of the church. How can we form Christians who can contribute to shaping an ethical society rather than necessarily addressing the state at the time? This famous quotation from Stanley Halvass, the church doesn't have a social ethic, it is a social ethic because it is a community of virtues, an embodied set of practices. As a result of this, it's less consensual, perhaps, and can be more radical and countercultural, this new strand. Not afraid of being quite critical of major social and economic trends. It's also less statist and more concerned with both global and local questions, and it's particularly interested in civil society. That's the area in political thought that falls between the state and the individual. Things like schools and churches and voluntary organisations and unions, these forms of medium-scale association, so mutualism and grassroots organising. It's perhaps, as I've said, less self-consciously Anglican, but it's more ecumenically, ecumenically indebted. And you see that particularly in terms of its dialogue with Roman Catholic social teaching. So there's a lot of sort of exchanging of ideas you can see going on here. So then who might we have as a representative of this new tradition? I think you can claim that Rowan Williams is. And he is in a similar way to the way the temple was for the previous generation, in that he was formed in a sense of academic debates, but through the time of his public ministry as Archbishop of Canterbury, was able to give voice to these new ways of thinking in a much wider public sphere. So, exactly. So, to a little bit of background to Williams' social thought. You can see a picture of him there with a banner in his more youthful days. He was involved in the 70s and 80s with various Anglo-Catholic socialist movements, such as the Jubilee Group, which came out of the Christendom group from the pre-war, which Temple had also been involved with, interestingly, so the two traditions aren't quite so as opposing as you might think. He was also influenced theologically by various ecumenical sort of ideas, including critiques of liberalism from people like Barth, at a Protestant end, von Balthasar from the Roman Catholics, Bulgakov from the Orthodox, and the philosopher Gillian Rose with her critique of sociological ways of thinking. But he was also very influenced by the Anglo-Catholic pluralism, which I'll come back to in just a moment, of John Neville Figgis at the Community of the Resurrection, who wrote a very important book about Augustine and political theory. So, cheery picture of him there. You may have seen his collection, Faith in the Public Sphere, that came out quite recently. And this is a gathering together of his most significant lectures and speeches from throughout his time as Archbishop of Canterbury. And you really see there the consistency of his thought and the themes that have dominated his political and social thought. So these themes, I think we could summarise as a critique of pragmatic secularism. Partly, I think, to do with just the different situation that Britain finds itself in, as it were, the 90s and noughties. You can't presume that secularism is such a benign thing as it may have seemed in the 60s and 70s. So Williams, in his book, talks about procedural secularism, but is in a way responding to more aggressive forms of programmatic secularism. Then he sets out a vision of a pluralist account of the state as being a community of communities, and this is something he gets very much from Figgis. So the idea here is that a good model of political theory should not be like the French Revolutionary model, which just says there's the state and individuals and nothing in between. But actually, this more organic English tradition of political thought that goes by the name pluralism allows for communities nesting within other communities. And I think this was probably the set of ideas behind his much misunderstood comments about Sharia law, but that would take a longer time to explain. So he has an interest in these questions of civil society and of associationism, so forms of association that are voluntary association, as it were, not things that are created by the state, nor simply individual things, but things like unions and charities and societies, the third sector, if you like. And then this sacramental view of the material world, which he says influences an approach to the global economy which resists the fantasy of unlimited material growth, because he says we need a sober and realistic scaling down of our consumption and pollution. And the same sacramental vision stresses global solidarity with the poorest and the most vulnerable. So just a little question then, as to whether this new wave of Anglican social thought may in some ways not be so new after all, but may actually be a return to an earlier tradition. In breaking away from that 70s and 80s temporal tradition, it has perhaps returned to the strand that was more dominant in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And these earlier strands were more theological, more ecclesial, more ethical, rather than narrowly political. So they thought, as it were, it mattered how people lived their lives. You couldn't just get the state policies right. You also had to have people behaving in the right way, whether that was business leaders, consumers, people at every level of economic and public life. And it has this interest in, as I said, questions of civil society and association, and more sacramental. So that older tradition was very much scorned in the 20th century by, as it were, secular forms of socialism. The Marxist and Fabian traditions were very critical of these Christian socialist ways of thinking. Two quotations here. These Christian socialists are a set of medieval parsons who want to hinder the independence and self-help of the men and bring them to absolute feudal maxims. And then a famous one from the Communist Manifesto: Christian socialism is but the holy water with which the priest consecrates the heart burnings of the aristocrat. You can see a little rich person at the top there giving some money to a poor person. Yet, I think my suggestion would be that perhaps in the light of 1989, all of the Berlin Wall, and 2009, the global economic crisis, there has been, in political thought and ethical theory, a renewed sense that neither the state nor the market can solve all our social and economic problems. And this has been a very big theme in Catholic social teaching, going back to Leo XIII in the 19th century, very strongly stressed by John Paul II and Benedict XVI as well, that neither the state nor the market will suffice for a Christian way of thinking about politics and society. And this has opened the way for a reconsideration of ethical, religious, and environmental forms of socialism and social thought. Brings us back to Bertolt Westcott. I'm sure you know all these very basic biographical facts here. It's worth noting the sort of institutions and places he was involved with, which do perhaps confirm something of that caricature of Christian socialism. I mean, these were elite figures in elite institutions, but that doesn't, it seems to me, take away from the interest of what they were trying to do. Of course, towards the end of his career, his time at Westminster gave him a platform, particularly for engaging with national debate, so that, I think, shaped his political thought. He was the first president of the Christian Social Union, which he founded with Scott Holland and Gore, and he famously mediated in the 1892 Durham coal miner strike, which you can see in that little photograph of one of the windows from the All Saints Church over there. So, just a very brief few minutes on some of Westcott's social thoughts, and how perhaps there might be parallels here with what we've already seen in Williams's thought and this more recent revival of Anglican social thought. First, I've put here incarnational sacramentalism and solidarity. So this is the sort of theological basis of his social thought. Two quotations for you here. The gospel of Christ, the word incarnate, gives back to every child of earth through the atonement his spiritual sovereignty over the world, and shows him how the kingdom over which he is set becomes one great sacrament of the Heavenly Father. So this is part of that sense that material things, the ordinary material things of life, questions of food and, as someone famously said, drains, matter in relation to the gospel. The gospel is not just about, as it were, what happens when you die. It is about this world and the world of the material world because of the logic of the incarnation. And following from that, this sense that the whole world is potentially sacramental, which shapes a different way of relating to material resources and to the environment, as we heard briefly from Rowan. And the second quotation, the gospel of Christ, the word incarnate, declares with a pathetic and irresistible power the unity of mankind, so that we cannot for one moment separate ourselves from any who share with us that nature which he has taken to himself. So again, the sense that the logic of the incarnation entails a radical solidarity with every other human being on the planet. Following from that, he develops a particular theology of the kingdom and the church, a particular ecclesiology, where he speaks of the kingdom as the establishment of a divine society on earth, and the church as the realization of the brotherhood of man. Forgive the language there. Behind this, you can see very much the sort of Platonic, organic ways of thinking about society that were popularised in the 1840s by F.D. Morris, one of the first people to describe himself as a Christian socialist. So Morris's thought is very much behind Westcott here. He has this nice line about how instead of equality, liberty and fraternity, the gospel offers righteousness, peace and joy. So he's engaging critically with that post-revolutionary continental tradition, but and trying to show how the gospel, as it were, has some things in common with it, but also goes beyond it. Social work, he says, is indeed at the essence of the gospel. And we see in his writings a sympathy for progress and social reform, but not for particular political parties. So although he uses this phrase, Christian socialism, he doesn't by that need to limit himself to engaging with either the then dominant Whig party or with the sort of nascent Labour movement. He has also a strong sense of the global destiny of the British Empire, which is perhaps one of the things that may cause us to raise our eyebrows when we read it now. But there's obviously an enormous sense at the time that if international peace and development are to be anything more than pipe dreams, that it will be the British Empire that will play at least a very big part in the establishment of those things. But we might think that it comes with a certain sort of similar naivety to the language that we sometimes find Americans using about America's similar role in the world today. So moving on from this to his, what Brooke Foss Westcott means by socialism and cooperation. He speaks of true socialism as having no necessary affinity with any forms of violence or confiscation or class selfishness. So he's already distinguishing himself from that Marxist tradition. In the in the late 19th century there, saying that it's not about seeing classes as being necessarily in conflict. The method of socialism is cooperation, he says, and the method of individualism is competition. And again, this is very much F.T. Morris's language. The gospel is about the ethical task of cooperation rather than an individualistic philosophy of competition. It's also a strand that goes back through British political thought to Ruskin. He has this line here where he says, socialism seeks such an organisation of life as shall secure for everyone the most complete development of his powers. So it is interested in, as it were, the organisation of the forms of social life. But, as you see from the next quotation, I can see no enduring hope for men in any change of circumstances effected from without. So, by contrast, perhaps, with that more purely policy-driven forms of socialism, Westcott thinks that this must be a transformation that begins in the heart of people. It is an ethical project as well as a purely, narrowly political one. He speaks, I think, in a few sort of asides that are perhaps, he doesn't really develop as much as we might like, but are particularly pregnant for certain contemporary discussions about labour and capital as having a social destiny. They are, he says, ordered to the common good rather than private use. And he says, every discovery affecting man's well-being is the property of the race and not of the finder. So there's a very strong restatement here of what was in fact the classical medieval Christian view of ownership as being essentially ordered to the common good and private ownership as only secondary and more derivative. And obviously you can see how that would have important consequences potentially for debates about intellectual property and the ownership of, for example, drugs and contemporary questions like that. Then again, picking up this ethical theme of how is it that we all have a radical solidarity with one another, he says, as we live by others, we can find no rest till we live for others. So he's moving there from, as it were, a description of human existence as being bound up with other people to a set of ethical prescriptions. So this is my final note just to end on. But Westcott was obviously a product of his age, with all its limitations. Yet I think perhaps the recent renewal of Anglican social thought has significant parallels with his approach to social issues. And as we find ourselves today thinking through questions of globalisation, trade justice and development, food security, the protection of the environment and the regulation of international finance and taxation, more responsible forms of corporate governance and so on, we may well find useful resources in this tradition of sacramental socialism.
John is very happy to answer some questions. I'm going to ask John to repeat the question so that those of you who are listening through the loop can hear that. Do you want to say who you are?
I'm Howard Haynes. Thank you for a fascinating presentation. I'm aware that the language which Bishop Westcott used on occasions, I wish that it could perhaps be used today, but there's certain phrases that can't quite be used today, like the power of the resurrection being a pathetic and irresistible power. And yet I think that there is resources for reflection in that use of the word pathetic. It shouldn't just be discarded or laid aside. One of the questions which fascinates me is, in a sense, the engagement between Christianity and Buddhism when you are looking at the world and morality and power. And it seems to me that one of the great differences is to be found somewhere in this word pathetic.
Yes, so the point is about Christianity and Buddhism and about possible differences that might be connected with this word pathetic. I think I have an idea where you're going with that, but do you want to?
No, you're right.
Okay, so Westcott, of course, was very interested in world religions and wrote particularly about Indian religions. And he's interested in them in a way that's sort of reminiscent of Weber. He's interested in them as forms of social life. And so he's exactly concerned with how different religions embody different ethics. And he has a sense that the final truth and the supreme, as it were, form of ethical life is to be found in Christianity, but he's not averse to seeing elements of this in other religions. And he has some quite interesting comments in his social writings about Franciscanism and the Quakers, which perhaps has some sort of parallels with some of the questions about Buddhism. And I certainly think he thinks that a sense of humility and self-sacrifice are at the heart of social transformation. Beyond that, I think I need to think a little bit longer to work out how to join up the dots with Buddhism. I guess I would also say, I suppose, that he, in common with that sort of Ruskin Morris tradition, he does think that feelings are play a part in social transformation because, as it were, by contrast with perhaps certain forms of Marxist ways of thinking or certain sorts of liberal Kantian ways of thinking, people are changed by what they desire. And so if you're going to transform society, you need to be in the business of shaping feelings and desires.
Tim and then.
Yes, I was delighted at the presentation you gave on the wall with all the pictures of these famous and important people. Only one, however, was of the female thinker, Octavia Hill. Can it be that there have been no female thinkers since?
So this is the second time I've been asked the question, so when I gave this presentation, or another version of this presentation before, so I feel you ought to have found something to respond between now and then. I think the tradition that I'm looking at is primarily a textual tradition, and it's a tradition which had a certain authority within the church and the academy in the late 19th and early 20th century. And those worlds were primarily male worlds. I think there is an interesting and rather different research to be done on particularly in the late 19th and early 20th century, a number of important British Christian social reformers and activists. Many of them were women, and it's not as if they left no record of their social thoughts, and they did what they did, but they also wrote about it at times, but in more informal ways and in ways that didn't gain the same amount of public audience, I'm afraid. But I'm sure I will certainly take that chastisement as an encouragement to delve around and try and find some archival stuff. These people
before
I get this
talk again.
Tim.
Tim McQuiven, Cambridge Methodist Superintendent Minister. John, thank you very much for your talk. I recognise that in my own Methodist tradition there are quite a strong stream of sacramental socialism at one stage of its 20th century developments, which may have found common ground with those of the Temple School in a much more ecumenical spirit. Particularly in the life and work movement. I wonder to what extent there are still possibilities for that dialogue with other Christian traditions, traditions other than the Roman Catholic tradition that you focused upon.
So the question was about the parallels with sacramental socialism in the Methodist Church and whether what potential there might be for that at the moment ecumenically, leaving aside the Roman Catholic Church. I have a sense myself that there have been, in Britain, quite a lot of very successful ecumenical collaborations in social concerns, so that one might speak again of a more latent social tradition. And again, the picture at the bottom is from the G8 and the IF campaign, which has obviously been supported by Christian Aid. And I think if one were to look for where a lot of the contemporary as it were, grassroots Anglican social thought is at the moment. It's shaped by these charitable agencies, which are mainly ecumenical, such as Christian Aid. I just don't know in British non-Anglican and Roman Catholic thought who the figures I would go to particularly find that sort of dialogue. Although I guess Hauerwas is obviously coming out of a sort of Methodist tradition, and I think sort of Methodist tradition. Yes. So and I think one of the things that would characterise this wave of thinkers is that they, as I said, wouldn't particularly think of themselves as distinctively Anglican. So in that sense, at the level of the academy, these ideas are moving across denominational traditions quite free, as it were, which I think is a good thing. And I'm sure that's true historically as well. Certainly, in the early 20th century, a lot of the work that Temple was involved with through COPEC was sort of pan-Christian, sort of British social thought.
My understanding, I could be wrong, that the basis of the food bank movement and also some of the pilgrimage projects in London and Southwark actually come from Free Church origin. A lot of Anglican clergy are getting involved with that, but if you look back to where those initiatives are starting, which are within this tradition, quite often you find a Free Church person who's actually starting off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so Luke Bretherton, who I mentioned there, is an Anglican evangelical who his involvement in community organising, which has been one of the more grassroots manifestations, if you like, of this new approach to social questions. And that movement is very much not just ecumenical, but sort of as wide as it can be, including Jews and Muslims and people of no faith. And one of the things that I think Bretherton's book, which won the Michael Ramsay Prize just this year, I think it's called Christianity in Contemporary Politics, one of the things he manages to give a very clear account of is how this new sort of strand of social thinking, of Christian social thought, is able to be more self-confidently Christian, but at the same time, perfectly able to collaborate in a much more ad hoc way with people of any faith and none. So it's not, as it were, just a retrenchment and only talking to Christians, but that those type of collaborations can be more successful and fruitful if, as it were, we are honest about where we're coming from and speak from our traditions rather than pretending to speak from some common ground that we don't necessarily have. So I think that Bretherton's writings on that are quite helpful in terms of seeing how this new wave is not a sort of fortress approach to social questions, as perhaps it did look at times in the 80s, and I think it's worth saying, you know, early Hauerwas and early Milbank got a lot of people's backs up by these very polemical critiques of forms of secularism. And perhaps one of the interesting things about the next generation is the way that that's been sort of modified a little bit or taken a slightly different turn.
In a lot of practical ways, I think that the church this. And I was also interested, why didn't you do Peter Selby?
Yes, I mean, just an omission. So I like as David Jenkins would be another figure who one could include. I sort of think of Jenkins and Selby as slightly maverick figures within the Anglican tradition, who in that sense have something in common with the transition beyond. So that's perhaps why I didn't to draw too much out of that. Sorry, what was the
first question? Church German.
Oh, yes, the Church German.
None of that's necessarily related or doesn't relate to
the honest truth is I don't really have a sense at the moment of where the Church German Fund is in its current work. And one of the things we've been talking about with the Westcott Resources Group is whether we might engage with the Church Heaven Fund and the work that they've been doing. But it certainly came out of Faith in the City. It was, in that sense, a very classically old temple tradition style, where indeed the problem, you have a big central pot of money, and you. Although, of course, I suppose the fact that it tends to go to grassroots church projects, most of its money, has the potential again to show ways in which it it might have more in keeping with that more recent turn to the church and to local ways of thinking about society.
My own follow-up is up with a feeling that this tradition has actually got lost within the church in Oxford area.
The temple tradition, or I think that's probably true. So I think it's quite a common reaction if you're to ask an Anglican social thought to say that it sort of dies around 1990, something like that, and then the church becomes preoccupied with internal questions, primarily about gender and sexuality, and stops talking about society altogether. I think there is some truth in that. I think some of the work that I've been trying to draw out here that began in the academy and has now spilled over into the wider church is more hopeful in that sense. And I think particularly Rowan will really can see that tradition sort of making a national contribution again. So I'm hopeful.
You mentioned Rowan a lot, but it's an obvious question to ask where just in well being fits into this.
The question about where just in well being fits into this. He's it, I suppose. I've only seen a few things, as many of you will have done in the papers, but Justin Welby had an involvement with the von Hugo Institute some time ago here in Cambridge, which is an institute for Catholic social thought, and he's very familiar with that tradition, and of course his involvement in the Commission on Banks has been a very public way that being able to engage with those questions. So I'm hopeful that that he will continue and develop that tradition. I don't think it would be too much breaking confidences to say that one of the other people involved in this project was asked with two other people to meet with Justin before he had to prepare some major work recently in response to some of these government discussions about the reform of the banking sector. So I think he's well aware of these roots, and according to the person who went along to that meeting, he is both very well informed and very willing to listen and learn from others about it. So the situation looks hopeful.
John, I want to take the to thank John for giving us a whistle stop, but an extraordinarily clear summary of both the history and of some of the key points and what the developments are today, and for many of us, what the hope is for today around some of these issues. So I'm enormously encouraged by what you say, and I think we're encouraged here in this community. I was struck when you were talking about some of the characteristics of what was important for Westcott, that whilst he didn't establish this community as a residential community, that was an outflowing of his original intentions, I'm very conscious that the way we conduct ourselves here does revolve around some sort of concept of divine society, that we talk about being called to live together, and we talk about cooperation, and cooperation as being part of the essence of our formation, and that it's learning to live and work together that enables us to develop into the people that we are called to be. So we use that sort of language, which again fits with his attention to character and virtue. So there's something in how we are today that and we could, you could be a residential theological college and emphasize different dimensions than that, and yet those are ones that continue to be
important for us. So I'm enormously grateful to you on lots of counts, and particularly for today, and want to thank you on all of our behalf.